My hands are...
Okay.
All right. One of the reasons you should care about the bibliography is, of course, that we care about the bibliography. But why do we care about the bibliography? You know, why do we downgrade people for messing up bibliographies? Well, it's because we want you to do your research right. And the thing about academic writing is that you're not interested in hiding your tracks so that nobody knows where you've been. The whole point is to show your tracks so that people can follow you, and if you've messed up, correct you. Because our business is looking for truth. It's not just looking for our own glory or looking to get published or something like that. So, you know, as happened to me once, you know, I gave a presentation on John Ruskin at a conference and was thoroughly confident of his, I was discussing his relationship with a particular person, and then a hand went up, and I learned something about dates and religious affiliation that collapsed my argument. Okay, these things happen, and it's good that things like that happen, because then I didn't go out and publish something wrong and stupid about it. You know, I have one article out there that I wrote in 1990. Whenever someone comes up to me and starts to talk about the article, I say, no. That's all wrong. Go look at this chapter in my book. But it's there, so I have to apologize for it every time I run into it. Okay? We like people to actually get the facts right. That's what bibliography is about. So, I send you to your handout. An unfortunate student in one of my classes this year didn't figure out how to go to the link and find out how to get to the articles that are on our database. So when I said, give me a summary of an article, this poor human being just went randomly around the net and snagged something. I'm going to give you the first paragraph of it. The animal symbolism in Canto 1 of Inferno emulates the negative connotation within animal imagery assumed by Christianity. Dante's symbols, the leopard, the lion, and the she-wolf, symbolize carnal sins, which are divided into three categories of severity: the sins of malice and fraud, the sins of violence and ambition, and the sins of incontinence, respectively. In contrast, pre-Christian tradition embraces animal symbolism as a positive and powerful force, intrinsic to human nature. Those cultures focus on more honorable animal traits and distribute these characteristics to humans in a complementary manner. Pre-Christian tradition employs animals to describe favorable traits in people through their own philosophies and beliefs in the majesty of the animal kingdom. Now, I would challenge this author to say, go somewhere in, say, an area of China that's not very Christian and call somebody a pig. Find out how the reaction is, or call somebody a dog. So, yes, there's a problem in thinking, and there are a number of other problems in diction. Obviously, this is not an article by someone who knows a lot about Dante. But let's look at the person's bibliography, which I give you in full. And that will show you, because when I am looking at a piece of scholarly work, the first thing I do is flip to the bibliography and look through it. What's this person been reading? Are these sources worth using? What do I know about these sources? So, I pulled up this article that the student had sent me to and looked at the sources. Well, what edition of Dante is she using? Oh, the Norton Anthology of Western Literature. Do I know who the translator was? No. Has this person read anything but the excerpts that are in the Norton Anthology of English Literature? Of Western Literature? Well, clearly he or she hadn't gotten as far as the Paradiso, Okay, this shows me someone who's been irresponsible putting something out about a writer without having read the whole book. Immediately. Okay, let's see. Oh, here's the first entry. Beryl Beaupre, Wolf Symbolism, Healing Wolf Art Gallery. Healing Wolf Art Gallery. What does this tell you about the point of view of the person that's being cited on this bibliography? Healing Wolf Art Gallery. Yes?
This doesn't necessarily have anything to do with Dante, this website.
Okay. This is an art gallery. And Healing Wolf probably tells you something about perhaps some ideas having to do with mysticism about animals. Okay. It's not a literary authority. It's not an anthropological authority. It's a blurb from somebody trying to sell paintings. This is what's known as a popular source or a commercial source, right? So you don't want that. All right. The next thing is from the College Honors Program at Boston College. But I can't tell whether that person is this an article? Oh, it's a dissertation. Okay. So I have somebody's dissertation about mythology. I have a commercial blurb. I have an anthology. I have a psychology book. I have two encyclopedia entries. And then I have something from Reader's Digest, America's Fascinating Indian Heritage. What's Reader's Digest? Yes? It's a popular source, yes. It's put out by a company that sells, you know. The original idea was an article a day to be read in a single sitting, and they're really short. They're excerpts or condensations from other people's popular articles. So it's a tertiary source at best. So you have these things that are not done by scholars, and then you have this poor human being, Melanie Barker, putting them together, coming up with an idea about animals that doesn't have anything to do with having read the whole text of Dante, and presenting this mishmash of anti-Christian prejudice and sentimentality about non-Western cultures and sentimentality about animals, and balling it up into some hostility to Dante. I told my student that actually it was necessary to go back to our database and find an article that was by somebody that was, you know, if you're going to teach people how to do fencing, you don't put them against someone with a butter knife. So I wanted her to go against someone who's doing well. This bibliography told me that Melanie Barker didn't know what she was doing. Didn't know what she was talking about. Okay? You want a bibliography that really demonstrates that you know what you're talking about. Okay? And you want that kind of bibliography because you want to know. You want people to be able to follow you and not to go through and say, this person doesn't know. However, if you don't know, it's better to be embarrassed by someone who does. That's right. But okay. So I care about people being accurate and knowing something. Therefore, I care about what sources the people use. And because I care about what sources the people use, I care about how to find them. Now, go to the bottom of your handout here. Okay. Under the entry, why you must not simply swipe the sales entry from Amazon. Okay. I get this all the time. Okay. What's wrong with that first entry after I say why you must not simply swipe the sales entry from Amazon? The one that begins Lattimore, Richard. Yes, Homer isn't there. It looks like this person believes that Richmond Lattimore wrote the Iliad. And while I respect Richmond Lattimore a lot, I know that there are earlier editions of the Iliad. He didn't write it. Okay. So, why is Richmond Lattimore there? In that entry. Yes?
Because someone said on Amazon wants you to be able to distinguish between all the versions of the Iliad.
Okay. It's to distinguish among the versions of the Iliad being sold by Amazon, so they tell you who the translator is. Well, that's nice to know. But you've got to tell me that you're not, that you know that Homer wrote the Iliad. You've got to let me know that, okay? And if you are dealing with a translated book, you always go back to the author. Sometimes it's not something as famous as the Iliad. Sometimes it's some scholarly work. And there may be more than one translation or something like that, but always you find the author's name. Author gets top billing. Okay? Unless. As you know, there are many, many, many translations of the Iliad and many, many, many translations of Dante. If you are writing an article discussing the translations, if I were writing an article comparing Mandelbaum's translation to Hollander's translation, then I would have three things. That would be what I would do if I were comparing those two translations. I'd get the original and read that in the Italian, and then I'd read the two translations. And I would put them all there, and in each case I would say, translators. In this case, translator. Actually, Gene really translated and Robert didn't do much of the translating. So it would be Robert Hollander notes, but okay. Notice, by the way, that I don't go Alighieri Dante. with medieval authors, it's the convention to use their first name. So you go Thomas Aquinas, not Aquinas Thomas. And you ordinarily would say Dante rather than Alighieri. That's a convention. Because people went by their first names and then their last names were added to them as sort of nicknames. So then again, Duns Scotus, John Duns Scotus isn't known as John, he's known as Duns Scotus. Although Scotus is a nickname and Duns is just the town he came from. There are a lot of people named John. All right. So with very old authors, one has to kind of get familiar with the conventions. Nevertheless, if what you're after is the poem, you tell me it's by Homer or by Dante. Okay? And then you tell me the translator, and then you tell me the annotator, and then you tell me anything else, illustrator or... there aren't a whole lot of other things, but those would work. If you're comparing illustrations, once again, you would say, you know, then you'd give the name of the illustrator first. But then all the bibliographic information, you know, Dore Gustav, illustrator, Dante Alighieri, Commedia, etc. Now, why is that? Why do you not tell me, why do you not tell me the author and the translator and the editor in whatever order you please? Yeah?
Well, it's a lot easier to read if you know what to expect for finding the author.
Okay. Because all of these things, it makes it easier because each of the things has meaning. It's kind of like, you know, why do you stop a car when you see this octagonal red thing? It hasn't anything to do really with how your car works. It just gives a certain amount of order to traffic. It just tells you how things are, and you know, if you see I actually can't draw the signs very well, but if you see something like this, you know, there's a railroad crossing coming up. You look for things that tell you where you are and what's happening and where, and they're all purely conventional. I had to learn some new ones in Italy, you know, and then you had to learn what two bumps as opposed to three bumps as opposed to little dips meant in terms of how you're supposed to drive. But if you learn the stuff, then it makes it easier. Okay, so let's see. Here's the second entry. The other sales entry from Amazon says, Mandelbaum Allen and Dante Alighieri, The Divine Comedy. I get this one all the time. The first couple of papers on Dante, second term. If I didn't already know who Dante was, and I didn't already know that he's the one who wrote this book, that would tell me something. Does anyone know what that would tell me? Mandelbaum, Allen, and Dante Alighieri? Yeah. Yeah, they're collaborators. So, the fact that Dante's been dead a whole lot longer than Alan Mandelbaum has would have made the collaboration kind of strange. But what it says is these two guys wrote it together. That's not what happened. So that entry's wrong. It's untrue. Okay. It's not every case that I know whether two people's names there are the name of an author and a collaborator, the name of an author and a translator, the name of an author and an editor. You have to tell me. So that I don't go looking for, this Mandelbaum guy, he wrote this big long poem, did he? Find out what else he wrote and stuff like that. It gives me the illusion that this person wrote this piece. And you don't want to give me the illusion of that. You want to tell me straightforwardly. So you have some important things, like usually they don't tell you who the indexer is, though that's actually it's a pain in the neck to index a book. And sometimes I think they ought to be given better billing, but I index my own. But okay. When you're looking at these, okay, you have to think in terms of who has the most effect on a book. You don't even tell me who the author is because we already know who the author is. If you've got the name in the right place, that's who the author is. Right? Okay. What has the next most important impact on a book? The translator, yes. Because that person affects the meaning. So the translator gets second billing. Most powerful impact on a book? Yeah.
Editor.
Yes, the editor. Because that person takes out words and puts them in. And that can affect what happens in a book. You can have whole paragraphs left out. You can have, I remember once I had published an article and I was moving at the time when the editor sent me the proofs, so I lost them. Didn't get back to them. The article came out and I found out that he inserted some words that turned me into a union. Okay, you don't know what a union is. That's okay, you don't want to be one. decided to change a word in my article and change the meaning of the whole first page in the opening paragraph. He's now repentantly printing something else of mine, thank you. But okay. So, number one, author, number two, translator, number three, editor, annotator or illustrator, who'd be next most important? The annotator, yeah. Sometimes you want a book primarily for its annotations. For instance, Dorothy Sayers did a really ugly translation of the Divine Comedy, but her annotations have all kinds of neat stuff in them. So I send people there for the annotations. Robert Hollander has vast annotations. They tell you everything anybody's written about Dante for the last 50 years. It's marvelous. You don't give it to undergraduates because it looks rather depressing. But okay, but sometimes an annotator can have tremendous power. And then the last one would be the illustrator, okay? All right, so author, translator, editor, annotator, illustrator. You don't always have to give all of these, especially for instance if there isn't an annotator or an illustrator, but in general, it's better to err on the side of telling me more than telling me less. Because there could be editions of Mandelbaum, for instance, that I think the first edition really didn't have the annotations that are in this one. Let's see. Who is the annotator here? It should be mentioned, but I don't see it. Okay. Oh, that's right. There are other things. Sometimes you'll have what's called front matter. Or or sometimes editorial matter. You'll have an introduction or an afterword by someone. And that you would put before the annotator. So if there's an introduction, it would go after editor. And the same thing with the afterword. Sometimes you'll have something that's called a critical edition. It will have what the author wrote. It'll have an introduction. It'll have annotations. And then it will have a bunch of essays by other people. Sometimes students will, you know, they're in Lit Trad 4, and someone will give you Herman Melville, Moby Dick, and then cite the number, a page number for one of the essays in the back by somebody else. Okay? Why is that not a good idea? What's wrong with that? Tells me what book it's in. Yeah, yes.
Wrong author.
Yes. Herman Melville doesn't have the authority of this quotation. It's some critic. So what you want to do is always make sure that you then tell me. All right, so what about in my text, an introduction or a critical essay? What do I do? I should stay here where this thing can hear me, shouldn't I? Okay. You're going to tell me who the author of this is, and that name's got to show up on the bibliography if you're using that essay. And then you tell me that it's in the edition of Moby Dick you're using, or it's in the edition of Jane Austen you're using. But you want me to know that you're using this person's essay, so you don't confuse yourself or confuse me by having me think that I don't remember Melville writing that. What is this? And then I find out that it's not Melville; it's some critic. All right, so. It's because we care about, partly about giving credit to people, partly about what kind of authority something has. Notice how I looked over this bibliography and I pointed out the things that don't have any authority. The popular excerpts from Reader's Digest don't tell me anything that I can depend on about anthropology. They tell me what sells to people who want to have some bathroom reading. They don't tell me accuracy about, okay. The wolf symbolism article, that first thing, doesn't tell me anything about the anthropology of the image of the wolf. Which actually, there's really good and interesting stuff on that. And it changes from culture to culture, but yeah. No, it just tells me what somebody thought would make some paintings sell. It's not the same thing. But all right. Let's think that you've done all of this sort of thing. And you understand all this. Rolling chalkboards are fun, okay? Gotta get your fun where you can get it, you know? But all right. Is there any circumstance under which you could use, say, Reader's Digest or People or some random website, as this poor person did, as a source? I've used some in my scholarship. What do you use it for?
Is it if you wanted to make a study of popular opinion?
Okay. If you're dealing with how either the history of popular opinion or how some author reacted to popular opinion or stuff like that, or what was selling well, so, you know, there's a real swelling of interest in the idea of the eternal feminine in popular literature in the 1930s and 40s. In popular literature of the 2013s, 2014s, 2015s, you find people denying the existence of male and female. Popular literature has extremely wide swings. And you'll have a writer, a poet, reacting to what's going on around him intellectually. So people writing about the ideas of the 1930s now would look very strange and sound very different than they did at their own times. Okay. People studying history, people studying politics, people studying literature. Less people studying philosophy or theology, though there are fashions in philosophy and theology as well, can sometimes get something from the popular literature. But you don't use it as if it were scholarly sources. Okay? In this sort of thing, you'd also have sort of advocacy journals. You may have noticed when you're closing your Hotmail or your Yahoo account or whatever kinds of accounts you use, there's a list of news stories. And some of the news stories will be things like the hottest resorts in, you know, Europe these days. Like, is this news? No, it's what we used to call payola. Somebody's bought a space. Somebody's bought some journalism. And that happens, okay? It happens in politics, in political journalism. It happens in stuff about the social sciences a lot. You'll find sometimes opposing articles put right next to each other that are both clearly advocacy journalism. You know, I started to collect for a while ones about the Catholic Church, but there got to be too many of them, you know. Hate articles and love articles, sometimes put right next to each other. It was, okay. So, if you were to make a study of what kinds of things were said in the advocacy journalism, yeah. But you need to be able to detect slant, popular appeal, scare tactics, bullying. It happens, you know. People will use a word or invent a word. Various varieties of phobic became big starting in about a decade ago. And so, you know, so now you have 15 invented phobias which have nothing at all to do with psychology. If you want a real phobia, I know some people who have certain opinions about spiders. Not I, actually. But you know, people who can't stand on the edge of a cliff or something like this. Those are real phobias. That's what the suffix was invented for. And now it's being used as a bullying tactic. So that kind of thing would tip you off. There are many other kinds of slanted language. But okay. Now, as you're looking at advocacy journalism and how times and places matter, another thing you need to know about bibliography. Okay. You'll start a bibliographic entry with right? Author, last name, first name. If it's a note, you put it the other way. And that's because a note is as if you were going along in the conversation. But this is the list. Okay. Then you give the title. Okay. Then, and this is both MLA and University of Chicago format. Okay, location, publisher, date. Okay. The title, I'm underlining it here. Ordinarily, you would italicize it back in my day, when we were using typewriters, you backspaced and you hit the underline for each of these to show a printer that the printer ought to put italics there. So, yeah. Or you got a ruler and went like that. But so, okay. Now,
let's think about location. And then we'll think about publisher, and then we'll think about date. Let's say you have a book called Jewish Influence in American Politics. This is fictional. I don't know that there is such a book. Let's think about possible locations. What would you think? What would be the likely slant of this book?
Negative.
Yes, it would be fiercely against. What would be the likeliest land of this book? Okay, it would be more favorable. Okay.
Depend on the author.
Okay. And it would also depend on the date. And let's look at this. Okay. What would be the difference? Yes?
Well, World War II made a difference.
World War II made a tremendous difference. Okay. Yes?
Economies.
Economy questions might make a difference. But in all probability, anti-Semitism was high in the United States in the 30s. Anti-Semitism was very low right through the 70s and 80s. Anti-Semitism has risen again in the last 10 years. So that these days, I would say, chances are if you saw something from New York, it might go either way. If you saw something from Berkeley, chances are it would be highly unfavorable. Okay? So, why do we need to know the location? The location makes a huge difference in what's being printed. Okay?
What do I do with this?
Okay. All right, once again. What do you figure? American capitalism, Moscow, 1928. Okay. Totally different political structures. So you want to know what's going on. Moscow, 1998. People were probably looking to see how can we get in on making profits now that the USSR has fallen. So you would look at this and you'd say, location, date, those are hugely important to tell you what's going on. One other thing that's useful.
Okay.
Oh, I found. Let's do it again.
I'm replacing in the whiteboard from here.
Let's take this. So, we have the date. The location, Pick a date. But let's say it's So, what would this one be? American Capitalism, New York, 1986, Revolutionary Crest. Which way would you figure it would go? Would it be different from, say, or Princeton University Press or the American Enterprise Institute? Do you understand why we need to know what publisher it comes from? Publishers signal things. Okay. Then there's the difference between a popular publisher, which is just going to give you whatever people are going to buy, and an academic publisher whose business is finding out what's true. Okay, so for an academic book, you have somebody, in fact, you know, one of the reasons I'm here. They sent my manuscript to Bill Frank. And Bill Frank read over it. Got to retranslate that. You need to read these 8 articles and these 4 books. Go back and do it again. I read the 8 articles and the 4 books. He was right. I didn't agree with all of them, but okay. He wasn't being paid for this more than like $125. He was doing it because, and I know this because I've done it for other people, you do it for the good of the discipline. You do it because you want people to print things that are true. In a commercial book, what the editor wants is things that will sell. And it doesn't matter whether they're true or not. There are more and less responsible sorts of publishers there. And one has, I can't give you lists, you get to know them by experience, which publishers are dependable. But I point out that there are really respectable publishers. And there are publishers that just put stuff out. And that information is something that your professor will basically know. So looking over your bibliography, it's, oh boy. Go back to the student and say, don't ever use this thing. Okay. You can teach people how to do that if they give you the information. So, why should I care about the bibliography? I guess it's time for it to stop, right? Okay. You should care about the bibliography because you care about truth. Because you care about not being misguided. Because you care about understanding where things come from and what point of view things come from. So, you care about the bibliography because it's the information that we need to help each other to learn true things and tell them to each other. And that's what the university is about. Okay, goodbye. The afterword. I don't know how to turn this thing off.